SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
XM201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to SiriusXM online and at our website as well, stevebick.com. And lots to do, and most of the schedule goes into a certain format, and you go toward Thursday where you know you're going to talk to Tony, and we got something good to talk to Tony about when it comes to his favorite New York bred in Pennsylvania, Collegeville girl, running today in the state bred Union Avenue. And Steve Haskin, who on Tuesday, the big reveal, he's going to work with Leonard Lusky and the Secretariat team, secretariat.com, and Rich Eng, catch up with Rich. But Dick Powell, too, review some of the racing and so forth. But things in this game on a regular basis happen, and you have to turn toward them. And the two Jays are going to join us, Jay Privman and Jay Hubdy, to appreciate Mel Studi. And Mel Studi's passing, word circulated yesterday with the family and everybody with him, son Gary, and 93. A wonderful life and as respected and appreciated a horseman. And I... Thinking about this earlier, I said to myself, "Avoid saying West Coast horseman. That's too narrow a description of how successful Mel Studi was, and what's fascinating about his career, which." Extended, six decades? Maybe more. as successful as he was with a horse, with horses winning Breeders' Cups, very subtle, Brave Raj, and winning a Preakness with Snow Chief, champion three-year-old, in 86. One of the things you heard uniformly from people yesterday, and we'll hear today undoubtedly, and Tracy Gans wrote a wonderful, wonderful obit in Blood Horse. His work with inexpensive horses. And, knowing that it's something that we celebrate all the time when we see modest purchases have success and get brought to the highest level by horsemen, and the identification process, the development, and then the execution of big time goals, and that's what Mel Studi is acknowledged for, is the ability to maintain a budget, a narrow budget, $25,000, $30,000, and turn them into, in some cases, Breeders' Cup winners. Very subtle, in fact. A perfect example, $30,000. And an outsized personality, which was passed on to son Gary, And I mean, one of, you know, for me, one of the, I think we had Mel on maybe twice, and going back, and the opportunity not to sit in, really, a tiny bit, but going to Clocker's Corner and the table on the, you know, you come off the Palazzo and up to the first level of tables, and to the right, the round table under the umbrella, and, you know, 6-7 chairs, and then fanning out from there, essentially a solar system, and the sun in that solar system was Mel Studi, and from there a group of a round table, sort of like Red's round table, right? The Red Auerbach, the Arnie Heff's pay on to Red Auerbach, Red's round table at the Chinese restaurant, right, in Bethesda or wherever. This was such a vibrant scene, and I mean, one of the in thinking about and asking around for who, you know, who would be ideal to pay tribute to Mel. I mean, the first person, and we'll talk to Gary when he's up to it. And I'm sure he'll have just obviously countless stories to relay. But Mel Studi would hold court there. The first person that I wish could express an appreciation and pay tribute would be Barry Abrams, whose voice is just, you know, not, his mind is sharp as ever. His voice is just not, just can't do it. But when I go to broadcast at Clocker's Corner, and, you know, it's typically I get there at 5:30, you know, California time, and the first greetings is the table of characters, and there's some roasting that goes on, and Barry actually let me a few different times I can think of, Barry called me over, and somebody always had a stack of PPs, or they had an article, Barry particularly, article from, you know, Thoroughbred Record, 1969, and they would riff off of, off of so many different things, and, loved to cash tickets, and, you know, loved, betting coups and, moments of, of anguish and triumph, a real titan of the California-based training community, and somebody who bridged kind of a gap too. I mean, went from a, you know, the tail end of the post-war era, and carried it into the modern era. And we'll let Jay Hovde and Jay Pribman appreciate, and got a couple other people in mind who we might not get to today. Alex Solis, obviously, somebody whose early career is completely associated with Studi. So you'll hear certainly from J&J, you'll hear from firsthand appreciation of Studi. And it's funny, I went to take a peek at some pre-modern era, call it 1970, and I guess the last 50, 60 years. But the first major stake winners I kind of came across, and in addition to what was acknowledged and included in Tracy's piece, Great Circle won the cinema and the Del Mar Derby in 1950. 1950, and just to give you an idea, I think the last horses he sent out were in 2011. Unbelievable. I don't know what it is exactly about the West Coast. We'll ask Jay. Let Jay and Jay explain. You know, Noble Trewitt, who was what, 102? There's something to be said about living out there. Del Mar debutante Tanga in 1951. Great Circle kept winning for a couple more years too, into 1951 and 52. The Santa Anita maturity. A stake that has, you know, gone obscure. Then in the 60s, the Vanity, Table Mate, Hollywood Gold Cup, Figanero, 1969. Another Del Mar futurity with June Darling, who was a terror that year. Won a Stroob with Snow Sporting. Starlet, Magical Maiden, another debutante with Miss Houdini. I mean, just a consistent success. And did it with a lot of humor and cheer and good cheer. So for Annabelle, his wife who survives him, and Gary, of course, daughters Jana and Gail, six grandchildren too. And this week coming up in just a few days, Mel and Annabelle were going to celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary. How about that? Unbelievable. And before we go to other things, we'll talk to Jay at about 9:45, and then Jay Hubdy at about 10:15. The family is asking for donations if you want to appreciate Mel's life and career and contributions to the industry. The California Thoroughbred Horsemen's Foundation. And that group, of course, works through and makes donations through the Noble Trewitt Health Center. And I'll send out the medical and dental services for the backstretch employees of Southern California. Mel Studi, 93. More from the men that covered him and got to spend a lot of time over the years. And Jay Hovde packs more into 140 characters. He's not a prolific Twitterer, but when Jay reaches for those 140 characters, he makes them count. We'll talk to Jay later. Regarding racing action and what went on yesterday, hard not to talk about those stakes and the terrific insight you got. It didn't help me enough, but it certainly helped some players, because I heard from some. How about the result in the Indiana Grand, a 9-1 performance for Hendy Woods and Bill Downs. Bill Downs directed you out to Hendy Woods. You know, he kind of went through the obvious players and then kind of focused out to, he said, outside and Hendy Woods. And how about Declan Carroll with just a tremendous ride? Thrilled for Declan. And Hendy Woods, you know, who's really packed a lot into this year. Mark Cassie for Barbara Banky and the Stone Street team, the homebred Uncle Mo Philly, made her career debut at Fairgrounds, came back and won an allowance too, then had a break and came back in the regret and ran a sneaky good race with some trouble. It's one of the issues, leaving from the 13 hole. And here she was again having to negotiate a trip from the 11. And Declan Carroll, absolutely tremendous. And, of course, you know, that regret, Harvey's Lil Goyle, who you're going to see Saturday back on the main track in the Alabama seven-horse field, came together, led by Harvey's Lil Goyle and Swiss Skydiver. McPeak also throwing Envoltante in there. Nothing wrong with her. Spice is nice. Pletcher. Crystal Ball, the Windstar Stablemates filly that Baffert trains. But this, of course, you know, kind of subbing for the injured stablemate. Bonnie South, Brad Cox, and forgot to bring her up with Brad yesterday. We packed a lot in with him. The Judmont filly, Swiss Skydiver, Harvey's Lil Goyle, and Fire Corral. A nice seven-horse field going the 10 panels. Hendy Woods pays $1,980. And then there was Amos, who can do no wrong right now, and in fact might be positioned to win a nice allowance race today at Saratoga in the sixth. But Pranked, who he talked about, gets Little Bridgemo, Germain, and a terrific three-horse finish here. Hendy Woods Pranked at 25+1. And Eva Lynn, Maker, who set the pace from far outside as well, was outposted and ran very well. And actually, that was a nice value on her, 12-1. That was a good number. She was coming out of the Appalachian and, you know, ran well there too. It's exactly what we expected. We said how entertaining these two stakes were going to be at Indiana yesterday, and it came to pass for sure. Hendy Woods, 1980, Pranked for Amos, 24-20 to place, 14-60 to show, and how about the $434 exacta? That was for $2. Paid $217.20 for a buck. Outstanding. And the 50-cent try, and you know, this was you know, tricky because it was a big field and there were plenty of other horses to consider. But 50-cent try paid $1,558. The 10-cent super paid $1,500. Yeah, so the $15,000 super with Dominga ending up. Dominga was fourth. I thought Nasty and Pass the Plate were my interest, and Nasty kind of chased meekly, and Pass the Plate closed a little bit, but it didn't really offer a lot. Neither one of them got much done. Then in the boys' race, you had Fancy Liquor, and this was also really exciting. This was another tremendous race. And Deshaun Parker, another outstanding ride with Fancy Liquor. And the Looking at Lucky Colt did go off favored, but then it kind of came through in an impressive fashion. Has now, you know, this horse has now got two wins and five starts, never off the board for Maker. And this one, Sky High, our friends at the familiar orange and blue. And Fancy Liquor follows up that placement in the Transylvanian with the win in the Caesars. Juggernaut, Jermaine Bridgemahan, again, Bridgemahan second in both stakes. And I played Caninos, who took a lot of late money. This, you know, we had that conversation with Cox, and I preferred Caninos, but Caninos ended up getting bet down. Ultimately, was 6-1 when they crossed the wire. I looked up again, and Caninos had been, you know, 8-9-1, and I didn't see the late movement, but came running and was the late runner that was moving best of all. And I'm going to tell you, I think you want to watch this Echard, the Frenchman that came up with yesterday with Brad Cox. I thought that was a very clever ride. He found his way inside and made, you know, had some choices to make trying to negotiate through that field. Keep an eye on him. So 660 for Fancy Liquor and Juggernaut, also double digit placement, 1360 at 17-1, and Caninos 6-1. A piece achieved, ended up fourth in there for Cassie. And Andesite, who was the slightly shorter price of the two Coxes, ended up fifth. Didn't really contend. Didn't really get much of a call in here. So really good action yesterday at Indiana, and the pick five paid handsomely again, $3,730. Every single day, Astro Man was the 3-2 favorite winner in the nightcap, and you had a 19-1 shot that won the second leg. Wyman for Kim Hammond, and Brad Cox had the 2-5 favorite in the first leg. So you had two odds on winners, well, 3-2 and 2-5, and then you had the favorite in the one stake, and then you had two prices, and you had a big number come back. And same thing, I'll slip in the Canterbury results too before we talk to Dick Powell. At Canterbury, again, we talked to Brian yesterday, and Brian pointed you in the direction of some of the winners. You had a $10 winner, Hanalei Sun, for Joel Burnt, start the thing out, and then beating an even money type. You had a decent price, $25.60 in a 7-horse field. I'm an 8. Carlos Moreno for owner Linda Idle. And that was one of the keys to the whole thing, if not the key. 3-5 winner, that Summer Revolution beat that field up like a rental car. And that for Diodoro, Arietta aboard, Leslie Mawing as the co-second choice in the feature. That was Plain Talk for Mac Robertson, a conveyance colt. Beat Elders, Novogratz Racing. And then in the nightcap, you had another favorite, Blaine Bishop, Andrew Gorecki, with the bug, the 5-pound bug, wire to wire. You had one tough horse to find. One. The thing paid $1,056. It's incredible. Almost every day, the thing is paying multiples of the parlays, and you know what? Three favorites, a co-second choice, and one tricky horse. I'm an 8. That was the Haynesfield gelding for Moreno. That was the tricky horse. And again, what did we say the other day? The wire, when you're looking for a wire-to-wire candidate, those are the ones that seem to be upsetting these, you know, these sequences. So Saratoga waiting for Dick, and you had a nice day at Saratoga, and it started out with the jump race. I want to visit this because Leslie Young, who is about as popular, you know, her and Patty and the kids, and Leslie Young has been around racing, particularly in New York, you know, for years and years. famous as a, the Siaka family babysitter, court ruler, the longest price on the board, as it happens. Unbelievable. And the six-year-old wins that allowance race and won well. Absolutely being driven by Garner and Nagel aboard Global Freedom. Court ruler moved at will and took over from Global Freedom. And you know, Zoom Zoom Zoe ran okay. Zoom Zoom Zoe had turned into the mojo horse. And seemed to be, kind of a universal pick, and ended up going off at under 3-1. But, it was rallying. I mean, it was coming a little bit late, but, really the top pair, 27-20. So, a little bit of a upset. And of course, we come back today, with that very nice group in the first today. 1250, $50,000 handicap to start the card today. After that, you had a variety of, okay action. The feature, let me get to the feature, and the Adirondack, and the Asmussen barn is just tearing it up. This was for the Hyder family, and thoughtfully went off at even money, and Ricardo Santana rode this horse like the race had been run already. Unbelievable. And when he asked her, she just was kind of loping along behind the pace setters and just took over. She's a Tappet, bred by Gainsway, and out of the Seeking the Gold Mare pension. And one of the things you've heard about this filly that's pretty exciting is she's not supposed to be winning like this at 5.5 and 6.5. She's built to go a route of ground. So this is a nice filly. The race didn't come back, overly fast, but she dominated. So we'll see if the spinaway is on the agenda. It was a good day of racing. We've got, I was sitting in the kitchen for the most part and working and making some sides because we got the kids in from Rochester. They got in last night. Tina came back from Rochester first. And then Zach and Andrea came with the baby. You got to see the baby. Yeah, the baby is in the house. I put up a picture. The baby's, it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to have a baby in the house. Dick knows this. Dick Powell joining us. And Dick certainly can appreciate it because he's got a second career. He's like an off the track thoroughbred with a second career, watching the grandkids. Dick, good morning.
I've been retrained or re-something. Our youngest is four years old, so she's
that's young still. That's right.
I know. She's just at the best age. What a delightful kid she is. Just fantastic. So, yeah, you'll have a lot of good experiences with the baby.
The baby. and it's just funny because we've got cats and I've had a dog here or there and you watch him do some funny things. And the baby just surprises you all the time. The baby that makes faces and goes from happy to frightened it's interesting. This is my first experience for the most part, up close and personal.
And as an adult, you will do anything to make that baby smile. You'll stand on your head.
We're already off and running in that front. Tina, this is the first time the baby's been here, and we'll be here, 3 days or so, and the house is full. It's as if the baby lives here full time. There's a crib. There's a bassinet. There's a changing table. There's a plaything. It's unbelievable. There's a jumpy jump. There's this really cool thing that attaches to the kitchen counter. And so the baby's got like a driver's seat. You know, it's like a NASCAR safety seat. It's interesting. Then the toys are piled. You know, the stuff is, and the baby doesn't have a clue. I mean, the baby's what, 4 months old, 5 months old.
It's fantastic. It really is.
Yeah, no, it's and they're already. I guess they're planning their next one too. They got a whole agenda. The kids, so we're off and running on the grandparent train. So I know what it's all about now. Dick, give us some thoughts. We don't have a whole bunch to dive into today, but we're gonna have Jay Pribman in about 15 minutes. But some thoughts about Travers and, you know, really a story that is developing that is hard to resist.
Well, for me, it shows you can make money with a short price favorite. I love 6-7. I do a play today every morning on the radio and just told everyone it's a cold 6-7. And I was actually disappointed it paid $15.60 because the seven Caracara was pretty long odds during the betting and just steadily came down. It was like third or fourth choice. The exacta paid $15.60. So to me, Tis the Law cannot be beat because he's that good. And now who's going to run second? And if you feel strongly about a single horse to run second, that's a terrific exacta. So Tis the Law was fantastic. All kudos to Barkley and Jack and Manny and sticking together. And the first crop sire, Constitution, just seems to get better and better with his offspring. And just can't win any easier. It's wide on both turns. And Manny just, I don't even know if he chirped to him. He just took off and That was that, but it was for me. It was a betting race because I
had
a strong opinion on the 7 running second.
Well, and let do me a favor, Dick, and that's maybe what we can kind of spend part of the conversation on. And you know, there's people that, you know, you see the comments. And people say, well, it's not a race to bet; it's a good race to watch, and that's just not. You know, that's really not what a horse player's rationale really should be, because if you're convinced and you don't think it's worth trying to beat him, I thought Uncle Chuck could come in and be that good. Your approach is really worth discussing, because if you knew that there was going to be a result that you'd get 6-1 plus, how much would you bet? You know, people, like, you know, there's plenty of people who anything above 7-2 for them, if they think there's a, you know, there's a highly strong likelihood, they'll send it in. So if you know that you're going to get 6-1 on a result, then that's a prime play, and so why isn't this a betting race? And I really respect that mentality that you took to it.
Well, and the opposite of that is when you get this wide open race where the favorite might be 4-1, and everyone says, "Oh, this is a great betting race." Well, not really for me, because unless you're boxing four horses or something. It's not necessarily a great betting race. It's hard. And with this kind of, I was big negative on Uncle Chuck. I thought that stride he had was a negative, the way he overreaches. I didn't like him at all. and the comparisons to Harrogate. I mean, come on, please. Just forget it. So I was negative on him, and I was a little worried when Orlando Notice Horse didn't go, because I thought he was going to go to the lead. So
right.
That would make it a little bit more interesting for Uncle Chuck, but that also helped Barclay's horse, because he had less speed to his inside. But as a bettor, the value isn't necessarily the win pool. You know, when we give out a horse and he's even money, we're not saying bet 2 to win on him today. It's all relative to what else you want to do. And in this case, with a short field, 7 horses, I'm not playing, and I don't play tries and supers anyway because of the takeout. But as far as an exacta, I'm just going one way. In fact, in the Haskell, I do that tip sheet for TwinSpires.com blog. And the Haskell, I played that perfectly, because what I did was they gave me basically $50 bankroll. So I went 40 authentic and who was the one who ran second? I can't think of the name.
And New York
and
Traffic.
The horse almost won. And
New York Traffic.
Yes. And then I came back the other way, $10 on top of Authentic. So Authentic went, I don't remember what the exact it was, $12, $14, something like that. And but if the other one wins, I got it for $10. So I had it perfectly proportioned. In the Travis, I didn't see any way that Tiz the Law was going to get beat. So now, all right, who do we like for second? And I had a strong opinion on horse, because in the Peter Pan, it was his first race off the layoff, and Chad's horse came back on what seemed to be a pretty good rail and beat me. And I'm like, well, that's great, because I'm going to move way forward off that race. And I thought the distance was going to help him. I just thought he had a lot of factors in his favor. So like anybody else, I'm not happy it paid $15.60. I'm thinking it's going to pay $20. Oh yeah, it's okay. But that's, you can, I mean, when I did those OTB bankrolls on TV, a lot of it was finding a solid favorite and going from there, whether it's a straight exact or a cold double or something like that. You don't have to spread out. You spread out if the race says you got to spread out. And those type races, I might just avoid, or if it's a pick five, I might have to go 4 deep. But a solid, legitimate single, like Tiz the Law, you got to be right. I was right as far as the negative on Uncle Chuck and the positive on Caracal. But the return was very, very good.
Well done. Then there's the opportunity on the multis. One thing that the multis afforded, for instance, again, this gets back to, you know, looking at a sequence in some cases where you know that you're going to be able to be narrow and trying to, you know, build tickets. The one thing that was right, really right, was kind of thinking that the Ballerina and the Troy needed to be spread out, and that opinion really worked, because then from there you had essentially between, well, I singled My Sister Nat, who I thought was, you know, was the right place to really make the stand if you wanted to keep a budget together. So by doing that, I was able to go basically two deep in the test and the Travers with the obvious horses, with Venetian Harbor and Gamin, and with Uncle Chuck and Tiz the Law, and, you know, was much wider. It was actually on the big ticket, on the AB ticket, was 6 by 7, and on the A ticket was able to hit the thing for what, $350 for $16 with the all A ticket. So in pressing, you know, the A opinions, utilizing a very narrow, you know, focus on a section of it, that, you know, that's a that's a productive yield. I mean, as opposed to people who looked at these cards and this card and have been saying, oh, these five horse and six horse fields are just they're an embarrassment and I can't play them. I don't get it. I don't get it, because Dick just showed you that the Travers was highly leverageable, and I'd like to think that the pick five ticket I put up was, you know, was a demonstration of an approach that can make you, you know, real money. You got over 20 to 1. So.
Yeah. It's just, when you see a short field, okay, but still do the race and then make your decision from there. Just don't say, I mean, my problem with the Ballerina is Serengeti Empress is an all or nothing horse. So it's unlikely. Now, she did run second in the test last year, so I'm wrong about that. But those type of horses either win or they're up the track. So as far as including them in vertical bets, it's tough, because unless they're going to finish on top, they're nowhere to be found. And she was spectacular, and the test stakes was spectacular. And also that gave me even more confidence with Tis the Law, because it's not some deep tiring track that he's going over. They just went 120.8 or something in the test, so the track was pretty glib. And I think he can learn the old saying with Pat Day, with who's the one who won the Travers in '87, the Rokeby horse.
I could never get. I never got him right.
He was hard to find on the right day, but you know, it was one of those horses that he could win over broken glass.
Yeah.
And right now, Tis the Law and I don't really care, you know, what he's doing with everyone else. I will care in 3.5 weeks when they come back in the Derby, and then I got to look at other horses in Art Collector and Honor AP and those types. But in terms of putting him in the pantheon of 3-year-olds, just deal with what's there. he's terrific. I mean,
yeah,
that's
very good.
That's the story. I don't buy the story. I mean, and I'm friends with Jack, but I don't buy the yellow bus and all that stuff that the quote media buys into. I'm looking at horses and odds and things like that, and just how visually impressive they are. The horse is tremendous.
Yeah.
And just can't say enough good things about him. And just all the things he does right, and knock on wood, he hasn't taken a bad step forever. I once asked, in 1980, was Easy Goer 88 or 89? 89. And Shug came to the Wood Memorial. And we interviewed him a little bit up the stretch for some reason. And Shug was really relaxed. Like, he just won the Wood. He had won the Gotham in Blazing Fast Time. He just won the Wood in a good, solid effort to set him up in 2 weeks. That's how far back we're going. And I said to him, does it worry you that everything has gone right? And he kind of stopped for a second. And he said, well, no, because, you know, we made all our training, all the races went the way we wanted them to. They were spaced out the way we wanted them to. And my question was, like, sometimes if you overcome a bad trip, that might move you more forward than if everything is perfect. And with Tis the Law, until further notice, everything has gone right.
Yeah, I thought the one sidebar from this was the context that provided to Barkley in the lead up to the decisions involving the Belmont, when it was going to be run and the distance. And when Barkley said, and I brought this up with Sid at the time, I can recall Barkley saying, I would have been comfortable if they'd left it at a mile and a half. And that in retrospect, was like a giant flare saying he's not only confident about this horse you know, going a classic distance and at this time of year going 12, that thinking back, that was one of those you come and get us, you know, we're ready for anything statements.
Yeah, his cruising speed is just
sensational. Yeah, that's now it's a real testimony to Barkley and Robin Smulin and you know, and I tell you what, the momentum that this is providing, there's a real it seems snowball down the hill pushing for Barkley to get onto a Hall of Fame ballot.
Well, last fall, our friend Nick Zito sent the Hall of Fame a letter recommending Barkley for the Hall of Fame. I think it was either right after the champagne really had nothing to do with it. But, you know, and the thing Nick and I had discussed, and the thing I point out, what everyone forgets with Funnyside is, Funnyside did win the Jockey Club Gold Cup. That's kind of forgotten. Everyone thinks like he won two legs of a Triple Crown and then went to Finger Lakes. You know, just won the Genesee Valley race.
Yes, he did. That's right. That's right.
And then his handling of it was masterful. And he's had obviously other horses, and now this just icing on the cake, and just the fact that Jack stayed with Barkley all these years, and Jack and Barkley stayed with Maney throughout in a business that's pretty cutthroat, where loyalty is not necessarily valued. That's the story that I like. That's the part that I like.
Dick, just a minute or two, I got to get to Jay. Jay Hovde and Jay Pribman are going to join us to talk about Mel Studi. But anything today for Saratoga or Presque Isle?
Well, today, Saratoga Race 8, I like Billy Mott's horse, Battalion. He's, you know, he broke his maiden against maiden claimant, so he rightfully came back, start allowance. He ran second. So now the winner is ineligible, so he comes back against the same group. He's 5-6-1 morning line. That'd be fine with me. Monday night we had the Tom Ridge at Presque Isle. Very nice win for Brendan Walsh's Guildsman, who ran well in Europe but hasn't really done much in America, but he certainly took to the tapete. He just flew home and just blew everyone off the track. And Morales had 10 winners the last 4 days, so he's up to 23 winners out of 66 mounts for the meet. Dick's picks on PresqueIsleDowns.com. Tonight, race 4, number 4, Bork. Race 5, number 8, that's Buckbeak. And I look forward to hearing J&J about Mel Studi.
Outstanding. Dick, I appreciate it. And we've got the Alabama on Saturday, and we got the 3-year-old boys and girls.
I like McPeak's other horse.
And Vutante.
Yeah.
On the rail. Look at you. All right.
I think the one, not saying the one's going in the wrong direction, but how many good races can you run in a row? And this one seems to have upside, so yeah.
Well, all right. You're going to get a number because Swiss Skydiver and Harvey's Little Goyle, they'll take the money. So you're going to get your number.
All right.
Good job. Saratoga Derby, and obviously Decorated Invader comes in as the heavy hand, and today they'll put together the fields for Sunday. The Oaks side of things, and as we wait for Jay Privman, I'll mention too, if you haven't taken a look, I'm looking forward to talking to Ron Gierkink on Friday. The Woodbine Oaks, a terrific field of 10, and in fact, the whole card is very good. It's plate trial day as well, and there's quite a few American interests in the 5 stakes at Woodbine on Saturday. The Dance Smartly, Chad and Brendan Walsh are involved, Etoile and Romantic Pursuit. Vicky Oliver sent a smart remark up for the Bold Venture and Clamott with White Flag, but of course they're going to tackle Pink Floyd in there, Pink Lloyd. And how about Chad with Delaware in the King Edward? And Shug, Norm Cassie, and Michael Matz all with chances in the Woodbine Oaks. So a very nice card if you haven't looked ahead to Woodbine on Saturday. We're staying right here, and as I started the show, the sad news about Mel Studi's passing, but at 93, a wonderful life and one of the real stalwarts for decade upon decade based on the West Coast, Mel Studi. And Jay Pribman joins us. Good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Jay, you know, I look to you and Jay Hovde and the West Coast contingent that had the pleasure, clearly the pleasure, of knowing Mel and covering his career.
Yeah, it was not unexpected. Mel had been in, you know, poor health for a bit, but, you know, just really a sad day. He had a great life, and he was a wonderful person to be around. I mean, I knew him for, you know, more than 35 years, you know, going back to prior to the Snow Chief days, you know, and was going through some old stories that I wrote about him back then, and, you know, and he continued on having terrific success. You know, obviously preceding that, he had terrific success, but he was following that and then stopped training about 9 years ago or so. But he was still around the track a lot. I mean, he loved to gamble. I mean, I wrote my story yesterday. He was kind of a racetrack dream. He entered his horses and he ran them off, and they didn't run every 2 months. He liked to gamble. And he liked to drink. And they even named a bar after him at Hollywood Park. He was very supportive of the concession stands at your local racetrack, too. Not to the point of being, like, you know, disgusting. Just, like, he enjoyed life. And yeah. That's what. And he was a very warm man. I can't think of anybody who would have anything remotely even tiptoeing up to negative to say about him. I mean, he was always nice, always funny, always welcoming, and extremely personable. I mean, just a real people person. And he liked, you know, just hanging out at the track with his friends. I know we'd see him when you'd come to Santa Anita. He'd be at Clocker's Corner there every morning, the same group of guys, eating breakfast, you know, with his son Gary and with, you know, with Barry Abrams and Henry Marino, unfortunately, passed away within the last year. You know, and I remember going back now, you know, more than a decade ago, but at Del Mar every morning, there was a spot in the stable cafeteria where Mel and his brother Warren, who was a very successful trainer and was still alive at the time, they always have breakfast in the morning with Henry Marino. Whenever B. Wayne Hughes was in town, he would always join them. It was a local broadcaster here, Ernie Myers, who was very close to that family, who was always part and did a lot of simulcasting at Del Mar back then, who was always part of that group. And I mean, you just came to expect them to always be there. And, you know, now, you know, as time passes and these, you know, legends out here are not around anymore, it's just a sobering reality. But he was, I really enjoyed him, and I know everybody who came into his company did.
When you look at the list of horses and, you know, the kinds of successes, there's a couple of things become evident. And, you know, if he had a horse with precocious talent, it's obvious that he was very good with a young horse. And then, you know, the success that was authored with, you know, modestly priced stock, and it seemed like there was a parade of comment about you know, his ability to extract performance and you know, and really get the best out of a horse that probably had some flaws, essentially. And when you see somebody bridge, Jay, that many decades and have constant success, that means, you know, that the market conditions, people that survive that, you know, the ups and downs of and the vagrancies of breeding and so forth, that's a real, you know, confirmation of just great horsemanship and an eye for a horse and the ability to develop talent, and that seems to be the hallmark with him.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, he did get a lot out of young horses that were precocious, but his horses lasted.
Right.
And I mean, he trained hard. I mean, he trained his horses hard, aggressively. I was looking up my notes, my story from the Preakness. For instance, Snow Chief blew out 3 furlongs. The Davy, you know, he'd run in the Derby, and then came back and worked, blew out 3 furlongs and 34-1 the day before the race. And then went out there and turned the tables on Ferdinand. And I remember, you know, having covered that Derby and Preakness, that, you know, Mel was completely at a loss as to why Snow Chief had run so poorly in that Derby. And he was favored in that Derby,
right,
in 1986. And he finished 10th. He just, you know, he was a very consistent horse. And for whatever reason, he just didn't fire that day. And I remember he was really down in the dumps about it. I found a story about him that said that when he, you know, got back to Hollywood Park, everybody was kind of, he said he almost got tired of everybody coming up to him and saying, you know, I'm sorry. But Whittingham said to him, look, you know, if the horse is healthy and he looks good and all that, you know, don't abandon ship here. And he encouraged Mel to go on with him to the Preakness. I think Mel might have ended up there anyway because that was his nature, but, you know, to have the guy who had just beaten you in the Derby with Ferdinand tell you, you know, don't give up on your horse here, you know, I think says a lot about the relationship that guys like that had with one another back then. And, you know, the respect that Mel had for Charlie, like everybody did, but you know, Mel knew that it was just an aberration with Snow Chief. You know, and Snow Chief was talk about horses who lasted. I mean, here's a horse who was terrific at 2, 3, and 4, you know, multiple grade one wins at that age, and, you know, just at those ages, and just, you know, he had a terrific career, and as off-bred a horse by Reflected Glory out of a Snow Sporting mare. I mean, his conception cost $2,000. And like you were saying, Stephen, I think Jay Hufty said it best yesterday. I saw something he had put out on Twitter, and I know you're going to have him on. He said that no one ever got more out of less than for as long as he did, than Mel did. When you think of the, you know, he wasn't training for the, he wasn't getting the $1 million yearlings and the regally bred colts from Kentucky. And he still produced at an extremely high level. And I think that's one of the things, one of the many things people admired about him.
We should bring up, I didn't get a chance to reach for Alex Solis, for instance, but you know, certainly the early part of Solis's career, I think, you know, got on a lot of good horses or helped make good horses with Studi, including Snow Chief.
No, I mean, Snow Chief was one of his biggest, you know, biggest early winners. You know, well, the other jockey out here who had great success with Mel was Patrick Valenzuela. Mel liked speed. He understood. No, but you know, you look at racing today, and there's a lot. I really think there's a lot of trainers and jockeys who don't utilize the best weapon that their horse has if they have speed. And there was never any chance that was going to happen with Mel. And his riders knew that. He rode guys like Alex Solis, Patrick Valenzuela, Martin Pedroza. He wanted guys on their belly when they came out of the gate. And, you know, like with Patrick, you look at his ride, for instance, on Very Subtle. And, I mean, she just took it to Groovy in the Breeders' Cup Sprint that day at Hollywood Park and just beat him at his game. And, you know, think of Brave Raj, who was another Breeders' Cup winner for Mel. You know, those horses got put in the race, as did Snow Chief. He didn't train horses that came from 10th, you know, in a field of 12. They were trained to be forwardly placed and to, you know, be in a position to do well.
I'm looking at Brave Raj, who was the champion, the two-year-old filly in 86. And, you know, it's funny. I did not have any recollection that actually Ben Perkins had her for her debut at Garden State and then came out west and changed hands to come.
Right.
To
she was
California.
Privately purchased by Dolly Green, who was the heir to a big oil fortune out here in California.
I love it. You know, she didn't, you talk about not being afraid to run the horses. July 4th at Hollywood in the Landalusi, then came back in the Junior Miss and, it didn't win either, came back, early in Del Mar, August 6th, August 18th, wins the Sorrento, August 31st, wins the debutante, and then got sent to Calder. To win
right.
The Susan's Girl and the My Dear Girl.
Right. All preceding her Breeders' Cup win.
Yes. Then she comes back to California and wins that was at Santa Anita that year. That was what, the fourth Breeders' Cup. And she wins.
For sure. Well, no, I misspoke. Third. 86 was the third one.
Yeah, Hollywood, Aqueduct, Santa Anita, and crushed that field. Crushed it and wasn't favored.
Nope.
She won by five.
That was, you know, they lasted. I mean, and that tells you what a good horseman he was, that they ran that often and still continue to produce their form. They didn't need to take, you know, 5 or 6 weeks or more between starts. You know, that's... And I really think that's a mark of, I mean, not only a top trainer, but, you know, when horses are trained like he trained his horses, they can take a lot of races because they're fit. You know, and I've said this often about, you know, when you look at horses who do well in the on the Triple Crown Trail each year, a lot of times the horses who do well going from the Derby to the Preakness are horses who are trained by someone who has their horse fit for the Derby, and they can handle that 2 week.
Yeah.
Turnaround. I mean, that's what, you know, they do. You know, but one of my other, you're talking to Steve about, you know, Brave Raj. Let me tell you about Snow Chief and his 3-year-old campaign. Talk about running a lot and running in different places. So, Snow Chief, his last start at 2 is on December 15th. He wins the Hollywood Futurity. January 12th, he wins the Cal Breeder Stakes at Santa Anita. February 2nd, he goes up to Bay Meadows and wins the El Camino Real Derby. Then, well, let's go to the Gulfstream, and he wins the Florida Derby on March 1st. Back to Santa Anita, where he wins the Santa Anita Derby, and then he goes on to Churchill Downs for the Kentucky Derby. Runs terrible, finishes 11th. 14 days later, he wins the Preakness. 9 days later, he goes to Garden State and wins the Jersey Derby.
I'm looking at it now. It just great. Just great. And to give people, you know, for those that aren't old enough to remember, you know, that era, and you mentioned Ferdinand, of course, and, you know, turning the tables on him in the Preakness, he beat Mogambo in the Jersey Derby. Looking at Badgerland, he beat beat soundly back to back in the El Camino and the Florida Derby. And Mogambo was in that group too. That was a good 3-year-old crop for him to be champion.
Broad Brush was part of that crop too.
How about that? That's Ruby. Right. 84. Yep. Yeah.
That was a very good group of horses.
broad brush third in both the Derby and the Preakness, as it happens. End of the year, he tried. Ferdinand, I forgot this, Jay. Ferdinand beat him in the Malibu at the end of the year, but he came back and won the Stroop. What a great! Why isn't this rivalry brought up as often as some other ones?
It was a great rivalry, and if you can go back and find the races on YouTube, some of Trevor Denman's calls of their races at Santa Anita that winter of '87 are great. Or there was one race, I think it was the Stroop actually, where they're battling head and head through the stretch, and at one point in mid stretch they're right together, and Trevor, you know, thinks that Ferdinand's about to get the upper hand on him, and then realizes, as he puts it, that the little snow chief is finding more.
Malaire was mixed it up with Malaire in the Silver Screen.
Well, by then Snow Chief was a little worn out, and he got a break after that. But that race,
yes,
by
did.
The way, he brought up the Silver Screen. That was one of the single best performances I've ever seen by a horse. When Malaire ran a mile in like 30, it was a one-turn mile then at Hollywood. And it ran, you know, just blew Snow Chief off the racetrack. She was undefeated, 5 for 5 at that point. You know, running against males in that race. But that, you know, I think Snow Chief, it finally had caught up to him by then. But Malaire's race that day was wild. And I know John Sadler, who trained Malaire, he was very fond of Mel and had, you know, great respect for him as well. I mean, Mel was universally admired out here.
And in fact, it's funny because I was, you know, I was kind of making the rounds for, you know, for candidates to visit, and Ron Anderson said you should have John Sadler. It's funny you bring up, and so I'll reach for John too. And he said Dick Mandela loved him.
Yeah, I mean everybody did. I mean you couldn't not like him.
And I, you know, I got to know him only, you know, to say, you know, good morning and at Clocker's Corner. And he was on, there was an anniversary of Snow Chief that he was on the show and was wonderful. But I had Gary on more often with Papa Clem and. I mean, if you want to chip off the old block and a character, I mean, they were just so animated, and the two of them together at that table, it's you could do a sitcom just based on that table.
Yeah, for sure. Lots of good stories, most of them true.
I'm just looking. Malaire, by the way, 132-4, Jay, that day.
I'm telling you, that was one of the. That's on the YouTube as well. That Silver Screen. I mean, that's a race worth watching. Just as a single individual performance, it was. I mean, just dazzling. What she did. She was kind of like the female version of Snow Chief. I mean, she didn't last as long in terms of her career, but. In terms of being off-bred and, you know, not much pedigree, but just incredibly talented.
Well, we'll talk more about Mel Studi with Jay Hovde in a few minutes. Jay, since we're together and given the proximity to the weekend, let's get some Derby watch in, because you had speaking of scintillating performances, Tis the Law. Confirms a lot of suspicions about him, and then really to a certain extent, Art Collector did the same thing at Ellis on Sunday.
Yeah, no, we saw the top two current choices for the Derby both solidify their respective positions. You know, Tis the Law's race was terrific. I mean, we all saw how he just broke Uncle Chuck in two on the far turn. You know. Tis the Law was going so much easier than Uncle Chuck and turned into the stretch, kicked clear of everybody else, was taken in hand late, you know, got a giant fig of 109. Just, you know, you couldn't ask for this horse to just continuing to thrive. And as we've said repeatedly on your show, just the job that Barkley Tag and Robin Smullen and the rest of the crew with that horse have done with him to keep him at this peak of form all year for a horse who, you know, he was ready for the Derby after he won the Florida Derby. You know, that's now, what, coming on 4.5 months since the Florida Derby was run. And he was ready for a peak performance then, and they've had to, you know, keep him going. And here they've, you know, just the horse has just gone from strength to strength. So I thought his race was, you know, as good as you could want. And then in terms of Art Collector, I mean, he's, you know, he has just continued to, you know, like, Tis the Law. He's 4 for 4 this year, and he's just continued to turn out one strong race after another. I like the way, you know, he was handled last Sunday. You know, as you know, I'm just a huge fan of the way Brian Hernandez rides races, and I thought this was yet another important but kind of subtle way that he helps a horse progress. You know, they went into the first turn. He's got speed, so he puts him in a position. He breaks well. Let's just go on with him. Let's not. He needs to get something out of this race. Let's, you know, not give up what we've been given here. So he's on the lead. But I thought this was really important. He doesn't drop him down to the rail. He keeps him in the two path going around the first turn, so that the horse will relax a little bit better there on the lead instead of being down to the rail. He won't get pushed down there by another rival. And he also, if somebody wants to come up inside of him, well, you know, go for it if you want. Nobody did. But I just thought it was a smart way to keep him relaxed but on the lead by keeping him, you know, one, in the two path, and by allowing him to strut out and go for the lead and make sure that he got enough out of this final prep that he needs to get, and not get cute, because they didn't need the points. They just needed a good race. And, you know, you could have, oh, let's experiment today and put him behind horses. No, because then you get bottled up. You don't get enough out of the race. I thought it was a subtly, you know, very smart ride by somebody who just, you can tell he understands what a horse needs on the day and what he's going to need 4 weeks hence. So both horses, I thought, ran, you know, terrific final preps for the Derby, and they're the deserving 1-2 choices right now.
Jay, fill out some of the other news and activity, because you quickly followed up after the weekend with a number of demurring hopefuls, and we've got some barn switches that I guess make sense to some degree. Your thoughts on how the field seems to be morphing?
Well, you can explain to me which barn switches make sense, because... to me, you know, I thought Max Player ran, you know, comes off of the layoff from the Withers and runs well in the Belmont and well in the Travers, and certainly looks like he's improving. So I mean, Steve Asmussen's a great trainer, but I can't fault anything Linda Rice did. So
no, I agree. I agree with that.
But anyway,
yeah.
Moving on from that development, you know, there were a lot of horses last week who had been on our top 20 list who, you know, just it was time to move on because they just didn't perform. Country Grammar, Dean Martini, Shared Sense, Chivalry, who, you know, we had him on there because of points, when neither Marty or I took him seriously as a mile and a quarter horse. South Bend, Uncle Chuck. And so we brought in, you know, Attachment Rate, who I thought ran a good race, finishing second after a very wide trip in the Ellis Park Derby. We brought in Necker Island, who was third in that race. We brought in Pneumatic, who's running this weekend, but he's not certain to run in the Kentucky Derby. We brought in Storm the Court, who's back in Derby play after, I thought, a good grass debut in the La Jolla, but they apparently still want to go on to the Kentucky Derby with him, so good luck. And then the horses like Finnick the Fierce and even Money Moves we put on, just because we're having trouble filling out 20. I mean, I'm not certain there's going to be a 20-horse field this year. You know, every year they always say, oh, well, somebody will run, but you start looking at the points list and calling trainers and seeing who's interested, and it's there aren't that many that are still out there that really want to run. And I think it has to do with, you know, there's been an attrition rate because the Derby's been postponed. There haven't been as many horses who came on late. And, you know, who wants to run against necessarily Tis the Law, seeing what he's done? You know, I mean, the Derby is the Derby in most cases. I'm not sure it's quite the same because of all the circumstances it's going to be run under this year. And I just, I'm not certain we're going to get a full field this year. And to that point, I don't know if you saw the story I wrote yesterday, but there's a lot of jockeys who might not end up going, who you would expect to be at Churchill Downs for Derby and Oaks weekend, to not go this year because there's protocols in place at Saratoga and Del Mar that if a jockey goes out of town, he can't come back. And so if you go to Churchill for, let's just say, only the Oaks and Derby cards, and right now the jocks might need to be in even well earlier than that, but that's being formulated. That's not finalized. But even if you go in for those 2 days, you can't come back to Del Mar or Saratoga for the final 2 days of the meet, and there's some big races run at those two tracks those days. So, I mean, unless you're on something really live, you know, like if you're Manny Franco, you're going to the Kentucky Derby. But if you're Jose Ortiz, who you don't really have anything right now, are you looking to pick up a 30-to-1 shot in the Derby, or are you just better off staying at Saratoga and cleaning up there? So, a guy like that, I mean, Joel Rosario, you're talking about Ron Anderson, I spoke to him, and they're on the fence as to what to do with Joel. They're weighing their options as to whether to go or not. So there's situations like that that are arising this year too that are going to impact not only who runs in the Derby but also who rides.
No, waiting for you're going to think that today or tomorrow that program for jock testing and so forth will come forth, and I've been maintaining a list here. You mentioned the horses that are running this weekend. You've got Pneumatic and also Jesus's Team or Jesus's Team and Jose D'Angelo, and I think we ended up with an 8-horse field in this Pegasus 20-point basis in terms of Derby access, and it would appear that if Jesus's Team, if they want to run in Derby, I mean, he's sitting, right on the edge. So you would assume that any board hit or decent performance could put him in. Some of those nibblers, Jay, Kiss Today Goodbye, Eric Kruljack, Rowdy Yates. Then there's the horses with no points, and Cheryl Spite. Atfield and Mr. Fipke have said that they would run potentially, and it seems that Todd Pletcher Money Moves with no points would run. So we'll see how this obviously after the weekend things will
yeah, and I'm not sure some up. Of those horses with no points, I'm not sure when push comes to shove that they would go, because from what my understanding is that there's some differences of opinion between owner and trainer in a couple of those instances about if this is really an appropriate thing to do with such lightly raced horses who look like they've got quite a bit of of upside. You know, and in the case of Money Moves you just brought up, I mean, we put him on the list just because, we know that there's been some inquiries made about running him. But, his last race was at Saratoga on July 25, and he hasn't worked since. So, that's what I'm saying. When you start doing a deeper dive as to, are these horses really running in the Kentucky Derby, you start seeing little signs that, still 3.5 weeks from now, they might not be there.
Jay, before we go and bring Jay Hovde in, a little bit of a quiet weekend at Del Mar, and coming out of some of the things we anticipated when we talked last on Friday going into the weekend, the two-year-olds. We had fun yesterday at the end of the show with Ryan Hansen, who got his first graded stake win on the thoroughbred side. And, of course, the Keep the Sormo and the Breams with My Girl Red getting Texas Red stake winner. As well, and we talked to Baltus and McCarthy about Bodhisattva and Smooth Like Straight, and there was the maiden race, and Louis Mendez, he's a force.
So he's got a lot of horses, trains them up in southern Utah and brings them down. He won four races at with different two-year-olds at Santa Anita. So I've written in that two-year-old story I do before the meet starts that, you know, he's probably going to have a number of horses to watch out for. And, and Ryan Hansen, we cited as somebody kind of under the radar to keep an eye out for. He looked like he had more than the normal for him and from a talent level as well, numbers and talent. And so they both had nice wins on that card. In fact, Mendez's horses ran considerably faster, and I think you'll see that horse back in the Del Mar Futurity.
Jay, I really appreciate the short notice visit to celebrate Mel Studi, and we're going to continue in that vein with Jay Hubdy next. Enjoy this weekend, and we'll be well into the second half at Del Mar and Saratoga when we talk next week, and we'll be that much closer to a Derby field in this unique set of circumstances.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to let me talk about him. I appreciate it.
Not at all. Jay Privman, everybody. DRF Privman. And Casey, your call. I know that Jay's waiting for us, Jay Hubdy, but we probably should take a first half break. And I think that's what Casey's going to instruct me to do. Let's take a break here. We'll come back second half on this Thursday. Also ahead, Steve Askin, Tony Black, Rich Eng. Back after this with Jay Hubdy.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Saratoga. It's history. It's tradition. It's world-class racing. It's jump racing. Yes, steeplechase racing has played a role in Saratoga's rich history and tradition since 1864. And today, it's a part of what makes Saratoga so special. Watch every Wednesday of the meet and two special Thursdays featuring the Grade 1 AP Smithic on July 23rd and the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup on August 20th. Savor the thrill of horses flying over fences. Steeplechase racing, it's a Saratoga tradition.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Dolly America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow! What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students...